For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program. It's the Indie Week, your independent weekly journal, read by John Federson today, and this week's issue dated September the 12th of 2024. And we'll begin with the Democratic Party infighting, I guess you could call it, from the Wake County Democratic Party, fending off their criticism of their endorsements in nonpartisan local races. We've had stories about this for the past several issues of Indie Week, and here we go with this one. The Wake County Democratic Party continues to face internal criticism over its endorsements in the nonpartisan municipal elections. The latest objection came in the form of an official complaint to the North Carolina Democratic Party from Seth Morris, an attorney and member of the county party's executive committee. Morris, a District E resident, said in his August complaint the county party's endorsement of incumbent Christina Jones over John Cerquera in the Raleigh City Council District E election violates the state party's code of conduct. North Carolina Democratic Party disagrees. Last week, the state party's Council of Review dismissed Morris's complaint and affirmed that the party is free to endorse whomever it wants, including in races where Democrats are running against other Democrats. According to Morris' complaint, which the Indy viewed, the Wake Democrats' endorsement of Jones violates a portion of the state's party's code of conduct that instructs party members not to behave in a way that is, quote, dishonest, deceitful, against the party's best interest, or harmful to its reputation. Morris claimed that a voter who receives a Wake County Democratic Party slate card listing the party's local endorsements could reasonably believe that Jones is the only Democrat running in District E, and that Cerquera is either not a Democrat or is otherwise unqualified to receive the party's endorsement. Jones and Cerquera's responses to the county party's candidate questionnaire suggest that they're both aligned with its broad goals and values on topics like housing, transportation, inclusivity, and transparent governance. Both candidates actively sought the county party's endorsement, and Cerquera also sought and received endorsement from the North Carolina Democratic Party's Jewish caucus. Caucus members had urged the county party not to endorse Jones, and District A Councilmember Mary Black for their support of a Gaza ceasefire resolution last winter. In the complaint, Morris said he wrote to County Democratic Party Chair Kevin Creech asking her to explain why the party endorsed Jones over Cerquera, given they both appeared to be qualified Democrats, but received no response. Morris wrote, "Deciding to promote one Democrat over another in a nonpartisan race without any clear justification has the inherently deceitful and dishonest effect of misleading Democrats and Democrat-supporting voters and misusing the goodwill associated with the broader Democratic Party brand to influence the election's outcome in the preferred direction of the WCTP Executive Council." The party's executive council, which Creech chairs, is a group of 11 party leaders who make endorsement decisions for the party. It's different from Morris's county executive committee. That's a large group that meets periodically to set policy for the county party. This intentional effort to warp voters' perceptions of District E candidates will have the downstream effect of fomenting disunity within the party and sowing doubt about the trustworthiness of party institutions, Morris continued. He asked the state party to overturn the Democrats' endorsement of Jones, but the state party's Council of Review doesn't have the authority to do that. According to a message from Council of Review Chair Sam Irvin, obtained by Indy, in the message, Irvin detailed the council's rationale for dismissing the complaint. Quote, As submitted, the grievance does not allege anything other than that a voter might misconstrue the effect of the party's decision to endorse Ms. Jones over Mr. Cerqueira. The grievance doesn't allege that any party official has made any inaccurate statements or did anything else prohibited by the plan of organization. Indeed, it's quite clear from the grievance that the endorsement procedure was an established one, and that Mr. Cerqueira participated in that process, albeit unsuccessfully. Irvin concluded that even if Morris alleged, if everything he alleged in the complaint is true, quote, no violation of the plan of organization or code of conduct occurred. In response to the complaint, and prior to the Council of Review decision, Creech forcefully defended the Executive Council's endorsement process. In an email to current and past county party leaders that the Indy viewed, Creech stressed the county party endorses in nonpartisan races every year, using a rigorous, consistent process, and stood by the party's decision not to publicly discuss the reasoning behind its endorsements. Quote, it is our protocol to avoid publicly disparaging Democrats running for office. In her email, Creech asked recipients, quote, to sign a letter of support for our WCDP council and our processes, linking to a Google form that is now closed. Creech ended the email with, quote, a non-exhaustive list of the negative tactics WCDP and even some candidates have endured before, during, and after this endorsement process. She said the county party's executive director, Wesley Knott, quote, received a late-night call from an unnamed Raleigh-elected official who said that the county party, quote, better not endorse in 2024 if we know what's good for us. She said in May at a public fundraiser for down-ballot candidates, a federally elected official, quote, offered me $100,000 for WCDP if I'd agree to skip all nonpartisan endorsements this year. Some local and federal officials and several members of the state party's Jewish caucus threatened to pull donations and support from party leadership if they went ahead with their nonpartisan endorsements, Creech said. She also referenced a letter from a group of high-profile Raleigh Democrats, including former mayors, former council members, and former county party chairs, urging against local endorsements. According to Creech, the endorsement's pushback comes from a vocal minority composed mainly of these well-known Raleigh Democrats and members of the Wake branch of the NC Democratic Party's Jewish caucus. And she wrote, where we have not had pushback is from the broader Wake County constituency. She also wrote that the NC coordinated campaign, the campaign arm of the state Democratic Party that works with the party to elect Democrats at federal and state level and provides resources to local candidates, threatened to withhold assistance from the Wake County Democratic Party if it made nonpartisan endorsements. She said at a meeting between her, not an NC coordinated leadership, the coordinated campaign offered the county party assistance with events and data sharing, quote, but only if we didn't do any nonpartisan endorsements. But endorsement interviews with candidates were already underway, Creech said, adding that a coordinated campaign leader told her, quote, that council was telling them they couldn't coordinate with us if we did those endorsements. And Creech wrote, in my 12 years serving WCDP, this prohibition has never been made. In late August, she added, both a Raleigh City Council candidate and school board candidate were not allowed to participate in events with a coordinated campaign because the party had made endorsements in those nonpartisan races. Creech declined to elaborate further on the party's relationship with the coordinated campaign, but says it remains in flux, and reiterated that the endorsements controversy has rippled through the county party's work to elect Democrats up and down the ballot. She says this campaign from a couple of groups of people in Raleigh to stymie our normal work efforts because of a couple seats they were worried about has had a negative impact on every single race in Wake County from the bottom to the top. It's very short-sighted and unfortunate and incredibly and unnecessarily divisive. Well, now we will continue with political election information, not news, from Southeast Raleigh and Corey Branch. This is a lengthy article that was published on last week on the 6th. On a cool early August evening, storm clouds hang low over Tarboro Road Community Center in Southeast Raleigh. Inside, a modest crowd of residents gather for the city-sponsored neighborhood night out, celebrating local law enforcement. Police and firefighters mill about in uniform, shaking hands, making small talk. In the community center's gym, a handful of people hover around information booths while their kids play or line up for the popcorn machine. The real action is at the other end of the building where people have gravitated to a dinner buffet in the multipurpose room. The buffet crowd doesn't hear Corey Branch, the District C City Council member who represents Southeast Raleigh, deliver brief remarks. Neither do the people in the room with him. The feedback from his microphone ricochets off the high walls of the half-empty gym, creating a cacophony of fuzzy, indecipherable sound. It doesn't really matter, though. Branch looks comfortable in the space. He's traded the jacket and tie he normally sports at council meetings for shorts and a red polo shirt. As he chats with officials and snaps photos with residents, his message is clear. Here I am. I show up. I'm accessible. I work for you. Whether all those things are true depends who you ask. Branch, a 46-year-old network engineer manager at a software company, was born and bred in Raleigh. He has represented District C for nearly a decade, ever since he unseated the late former council member Eugene Weeks in 2015. Through three election cycles, Branch fended off political newcomers and perennial candidates who never mounted a serious challenge. He stayed popular, advocating for more affordable housing, championing bus rapid transit, and consistently supporting CACs. Even before Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin announced she would not seek re-election in April, Branch threw his hat into the ring for the city's top job. But in the months that followed, Raleigh's political elite and donor class coalesced around his opponent, Dix Park Conservancy President and CEO Janet Cowell. Cowell, a former Raleigh City Council member, state senator, and state treasurer, has the support of two popular former mayors, Nancy McFarlane and Charles Meeker. Branch appeared to see the writing on the wall and bowed out gracefully. He said during a press conference in July, "There were calls and concerns and just residents saying, 'Hey, we want you to continue to be our representative here within the district.' Being a native son, you know, you have to listen." By the time Branch filed his District C paperwork and scrubbed Corey Branch for Raleigh mayor from his website, six other candidates were vying to fill what they had expected to be a vacant seat. This time around, the challengers are more serious. All say Branch has fallen short. Some boast deep roots in Southeast Raleigh and prior government experience, and one just earned the endorsement of the Wake County Democratic Party. Branch has his own friends in high places, including Baldwin and a popular at-large council member, Jonathan Melton, both District C denizens. Branch also believes his constituents, by and large, want him to stay. But if he was expecting a smooth homecoming, he isn't going to get it. In Branch's district, history is clashing with growth and development in real time. Southeast Raleigh is a historical epicenter of black culture, and against a current of segregation, urban renewal, and underinvestment, it became an epicenter of black home ownership. More recently, the area's relative affordability paired with its proximity to downtown and made it prime for new housing development. Many of the new units are not affordable for current residents, catering instead to the influx of wealthy professionals moving to the city in droves. Meanwhile, long-time residents see rising prices, property tax increase, demographic changes, and gentrification as existential threats. In this climate, nothing Branch does for the district goes uncriticized. As chair of the council's Transportation and Transit Committee, he fought to make sure that the city's bus rapid transit rollout began on New Bern Avenue. Some residents praised him for bringing new infrastructure and investment. Others say the bus line will only breed more displacement. With no perfect solutions in sight, the upcoming District C election is a referendum on Branch's leadership through this period of change. Some voters hold him personally accountable for the pace of development. Others see growth as inevitable, even positive, but complain that community infrastructure, grocery stores, bus stops, first responders, isn't keeping pace with new housing and wish their council member had done more. Compared to Branch, who has nearly a decade of council experience, his opponents are blank slates. They have fewer relationships, but less baggage. There's Daniel Grant King, a 24-year-old special ed teacher for Wake County Public Schools. Originally from New York, Grant King has lived in Raleigh most of his life. He served as Secretary of Young Democrats of Wake County and made an unsuccessful bid for a seat on the county school board in 2022. Grant says housing affordability, transportation, and public accountability are the biggest reasons he is running. He wants to add new public transit options, like electric buses, and create a city office dedicated to preventing evictions. And he says people are ready for change. He pointed to the council's failure to pass a Gaza ceasefire resolution as a sign that the body is disconnected from the community it serves. The council split 4-4, with Branch opposing. On the other hand of the ideological spectrum is Tamara DaCosta, a clinical researcher, longtime District C resident, and the only Republican in the race. Her top priorities are improving public safety and bringing more business to Southeast Raleigh, she tells the Indy. A newcomer to local politics, DaCosta thinks voters will appreciate her pro-growth, pro-small business perspective if they don't automatically discount her for being a conservative. Portia Rochelle is the former president of Raleigh Apex Branch of the NAACP, a role she says shaped her into a skilled community advocate. After twice running for an at-large seat on the council, she's narrowed her focus to District C. Rochelle says Raleigh should raise its minimum wage for city workers and pressure developers to build more low-income housing. State law, by the way, limits the city's power to do this. She also advocates for transparent, accessible leadership, something she says her background in youth ministry and NAACP work prepare her for. Then there's DeQuanta Copeland, Community Engagement Coordinator for the Wake Department of Housing, a role that sends her all over the county to promote its affordable housing resources. She's also the former vice chair of the Wake Health and Human Services Board, a volunteer position, where she advised on countywide policy. Copeland has never held the elected office, but she stands on her government experience, coupled with her 30 years as a Southeast Raleigh resident. And she says, I've seen the changes that have happened, all the disparity, displacement, and lack of knowledge of accessible resources in District C. She says, I want to help stabilize my community. Jared Ollison boasts even deeper roots in the district. His family has lived, studied, and worshipped here for generations, he says. Ollison attended Wake Public Schools before joining the Air Force. Following an honorable discharge, he worked as a deputy in the Wake County Sheriff's Office and later ran the Wake County Detention Center. He says, unfortunately, jokingly referred to as the largest mental health institution in all of Wake County. Ollison says working in law enforcement sensitized him to the city's need for better mental health resources. He sees gentrification and homelessness on the rise in District C and suggests offering tax breaks to developers who build income-restricted housing. Again, state law limits the city's ability to do this. Oleson pledged to donate some of his council's salary to district youth programs and says he does not support BRT on New Bern Avenue because it could cause property values to soar, displacing legacy residents. Oleson emphasizes he's in touch with the people and history of Southeast Raleigh. He says, when I ride down the road, I don't see the same things that some other people see. Sure, I see some blight, but I also see a prideful people. They want an opportunity to build what my family has built, and it's my moral and ethical obligation to find a way to help them so they can have their own story to be proud of, their own legacy to share with their children. Then there's Torulope Omokaye, a Southeast Raleigh small business owner who served on the Raleigh Transit Authority, a volunteer body that makes policy recommendations to Go Raleigh, for 8 years, five as the chair. Omokaye wants to make Raleigh more equitable and affordable. For transportation, that means adding bus stops and shelters in communities that don't have them. For housing, it means curbing predatory luxury housing development in favor of affordable and mixed-income options. She says, I was the first woman and one of the first people of color to chair the Transit Authority, and I'm very proud of that. I know with transit comes development, and I want everybody to have an opportunity to participate in that development as it grows the district. Community engagement is key to Omokaye's election strategy, she says, especially in a crowded race against an incumbent. She also won the county Democratic Party's endorsement, so we'll have some help on this front. Omokaye can access the party's Voter Action Network, a database full of coveted voter contact info, she says. Plus, her name will be on this party's slate card, a list of candidate recommendations it distributes during Get Out the Vote canvassing and at the polls. She says, we need to listen to everyone in the district, including legacy residents, and bring those ideas back to the council chamber versus going to the community and telling them what's going to happen. There are through lines in the candidate's assessment of the district's strengths and challenges. They generally agree it's a culturally rich, historic community with a serious housing affordability problem and need for better transportation and human services options. Unsurprisingly, the candidates also share a dissatisfaction with Branch. Grant King, he's only advocating for a certain group of people. Copeland, he's had four terms, and yet District C is still full of disparities and expeditious displacement. Oleson, his policies have hurt our community. People can't afford their mortgages, their rents, and our transportation system has failed. Many of those problems did not exist prior to his taking office. Branch tells a different story of his 9 years in office. He describes himself as a dedicated public servant with valuable relationships on council and beyond. During his tenure, Branch notes that council has approved more affordable housing projects in District C than any other district. And despite the BRT backlash, he celebrates it as a win for the community. Branch says his next focus is getting more grocery stores and other amenities into the district to match the housing and population growth, saying, we cannot put a wall or fence up around our city. People continue to move here. We just have to figure out a way from an economic development standpoint to help those who've been here to still be a part of the growth. People complain about aspects of his record, but he says it comes with the territory. You get nothing done without having relationships and trust built over time. I can call the Secretary of Transportation for the state about an issue. I can reach out to the county manager directly. I can also reach other municipalities across the state. How are they addressing housing in Charlotte? How are they addressing transportation in Greensboro? I have those relationships. Branch's council colleagues agree. Jonathan Melton, who lives in his district and has worked with him for years, he works hard to have a good relationship with staff and other councilors. Melton calls Branch a thoughtful decision maker and a good partner on district-related issues. He remembers how the two first bonded when Branch took him out to dinner to celebrate his election in 2019. Branch also has a friend in Mayor Baldwin, although the two don't agree on everything. They served together on the Wake County Transit Plan Committee, and in 2023, Baldwin named Branch her mayor pro tem. She says he listens. He holds meetings. He's out in the community. He is an engaged leader. The two have a foundation of mutual respect, she says, even when they disagree, as was the case when Branch voted against disbanding Raleigh's CACs. She says, we respected each other's opinion and understood where the other was coming from. I know that CACs are important in that district, and he felt an allegiance to that. But Baldwin's endorsement of Branch is not unqualified, she says with a chuckle. Sometimes he needs to vote his conscience instead of voting for something that's popular. She just declines to provide a specific example. Although Baldwin says Branch is the best person to represent District C, she says he wasn't quite ready to be mayor. Quote, his strength is he is focused on his district, and his weakness in running for mayor is that he's focused on his district. You have to have a bigger picture. I've told him this. Get out of your district more and build bridges with people throughout the community. One thing Branch is not focused on is the Wake County Democratic Party's endorsement of Omakaye. The party didn't endorse Branch in 2022 either. He says it is a select few members of the leadership that make this endorsement. And Kevin Creech, the county party's chair, wouldn't share specifics behind the party's endorsement process, but says Omakaye gave an impressive interview and cites her transit authority work. Quote, that was definitely a plus for her. And there are other people in that list who could do a really good job, but she just bubbled to the top. The Raleigh Professional Firefighters Association, RPFFA, also endorsed Omakaye. Its president, Andrew Davis, wrote, Omakaye's values, experience, and dedication to public service align closely with our mission to support and advocate for working-class people and the communities we serve. Outside of District C, the RPFFA endorsed a mix of incumbents and challengers. Davis's Branch hasn't prioritized public safety in Raleigh during his long council tenure. The last time a new firefighter position was created was in 2014. The fire department has been stagnant while the city has exploded with development and growth. The group supported Melton for re-election, but not Stormy Forte, the other at-large council member who has served multiple terms on the council. Branch says, I understand some of the Raleigh firefighters are upset and mad with me. He doesn't think many of the group's members live in Raleigh or Wake County. Still, he says he will do everything I can to make sure firefighters have tools and resources they need if I'm reelected. The North Carolina AFL-CIO, the Federation of North Carolina Labor Unions, endorsed Branch. So did the Raleigh Police Protective Association, which represents more than 500 Raleigh police officers. The Raleigh-Wake County Home Builders and the Raleigh-Wake Citizens Association both endorsed Branch in 2022, but have not yet endorsed in 2024 and did not immediately respond to the Indy's request for comment. At the Tarboro Road Community Center, many longtime Southeast Raleigh residents tell the Indy they supported Branch in the past and would again. He's pretty accessible, they say. He's there with them at the event. Where are the other candidates? Everyone the Indy spoke to at least knew who Branch was, even if they were undecided or uninterested in politics. In contrast, hardly anyone could name one of his challengers, suggesting an advantage for Branch in a field of relative unknowns. Elsewhere in the district, opinions on the race are more mixed. Ulysses Lane, a longtime district resident and chair of the Southeast CAC, is, as of earlier this summer, still on the fence. He thinks Southeast Raleigh needs fresh ideas to address food deserts, combat gentrification, and support the district's elderly and youth populations. Lane says, I know Corey. He supports our Southeast CAC, but I wouldn't dare make any commitment at this time because there's too many people involved. Rick Bocard moved to District C about 3 years ago. He likes Allison as a candidate, but says he's still undecided. More than anything, Bocard is firmly anti-Branch. Ever since Branch voted to green light the development of new market-rate rentals on Garner Road near Bocard's home. We're a heat island, a food desert, we don't have the things we need, and with all the residential development taking place, something needs to give, Bocard says. Branch does not listen. He doesn't take any of this into account. Octavia Rainey, a community advocate who has lived in College Park neighborhood for most of her life, agrees with Bocard. Like many of Branch's opponents, she takes issues with his leadership on the BRT project because, she says, transit-oriented development on New Bern Avenue will erase historically significant black landmarks. She says, I want to know why Corey didn't speak up and say, wait a minute, there's plenty of historical significance in the black section of New Bern Avenue. We need a council person who is about preserving black neighborhoods, about recognizing their historical significance. This race in District C is really serious. But Frances Lonette Williams, former chair of the Central CHC and 20-year South Park resident, describes Branch as a community servant and CAC ally. Williams thinks about Southeast Raleigh's development boom constantly. She has no choice, she said. She receives a phone call or mailer every day from a developer who wants to pay cash for her house. Williams doesn't blame Branch for the pressure on long-time homeowners, though, after all, it's the county, not the city, that's responsible for managing property taxes. And when it comes to the council's rezoning decisions for new development, she points out Branch's vote is only one of eight. She says if Corey was in bed with developers, they would have damn sure paid for his mayoral election. As for the other District C candidates, Williams says she hasn't encountered any of them in the 20 years she's been politically active. I don't even know their names, she says. We've had so much going on. Where the hell were you? Next, over to Durham and that Roxborough Mangum Street redesigned. Another article. This was published on the 5th of September. Durham is pushing forward on the redesign amidst Department of Transport North Carolina delays. The city of Durham is moving forward with its plan to design Roxborough and Mangum, two prominent corridors that run through downtown Durham, but the North Carolina Department of Transportation, DOT, says it still needs time to vet the proposal. In March, more than 200 residents joined city and state officials for an open house at Global Scholars Academy on Roxborough Street to visualize the proposal to convert these parallel-running Roxborough and Mangum from one-way to two-way streets. After months of discussion between public officials and community advocacy groups like Bike Durham, Durham's Transportation Department collected the requisite materials and submitted its proposal to DOT for review in early July. Nearly 2 months later, the department is still waiting for an answer from DOT. John Talmadge, Bike Durham's executive director, said the city had some conversations with DOT ahead of time, put together their package they thought addressed those questions, and now all sorts of other questions are coming up, which is not a process from smoothly moving from one step to the next. DOT has no guidelines for city road redesign. The department takes each proposal on a case-by-case basis. The lack of pre-existing parameters makes it challenging for cities to be consistent in their proposals and for DOT to offer clear direction. Kimberly Diener is Division 5 Communications Officer at NCDOT and says it's the first time it's ever been done. So DOT, our division engineers, our traffic safety engineers, want to make sure without a shadow of a doubt that this is an idea that can be done safely. Durham Transportation Department set an August 27th deadline to receive requests for design services on the conversion project. After months working with its own licensed engineers and contractors on their DOT proposal, the department is pushing forward to keep the project from falling behind schedule. The design consultant that the department selects will require approval from the City Council. Sean Egan, Transportation Director for the City of Durham, says, with the significant time required for council review, this approach keeps the procurement moving while we work to secure final approvals from DOT. Durham and DOT have played this game of chicken before. Last December, a miscommunication between members of Durham's Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee, BPAC, Durham City staff, and DOT led to the delay and restructuring of a road improvement project on Fayetteville Street, another prominent state-owned road near downtown. Egan told Indy in October, "We got a clear understanding of what riders were looking for, and now what they've told us is to stop bringing us surveys and start delivering results we can see on the ground." Some hoped that the incident would create a stronger line of communication and better working relationship between the groups, but similar issues have continued to delay important road improvements in Durham. Now time is of the essence. With other projects on the books and two infrastructure bonds on the ballot in November, advocates are concerned that further delays on the Roxborough and Mangum project would compromise the city's work plan and delay the project indefinitely. Talmadge said, "It has a cascading effect. The more time you have to spend negotiating with DOT, the less capacity you have to move all these projects forward that the city's working on." Well, recording time here at NC Reading Service has passed lunch hour, and here I'm presented with a restaurant article, sort of bittersweet, I might say. Lena Geller wrote this about a month ago. At COPA, C-O-P-A, a meal could be leisurely and to a certain degree dramaturgical, a stiff aperitif to start, followed by a succession of small plates, a slow roasted showstopper, a coffee pot denouement, a dark rum resolution. That is, if you wanted it to be. Patrons of the Nuevo Latino Bistro, which closed permanently last week after 6 years on West Main Street in Durham, didn't always opt for the full arc. In a downtown where nice restaurants are de facto DPAC pre-games, and where, as in many rapidly swelling American cities, the pace of life verges on anxious, the fact that one of COPA's entrees explicitly took 45 minutes to prepare was enough to make some customers announce their orders at the host stand. "Hello, table for two. We're getting the paella." "We're excited, yes, and we don't have a second to spare." On the restaurant's penultimate Saturday night of service, though, everyone seems down to lounge. "I'm here for dinner with my friend Gabi. She and I both worked in the front of the house at COPA 2 years ago. She also worked for a time at Terra Sacra, the Hillsborough produce farm that COPA owners Roberto COPA, Matos, and Elizabeth Turnbull also own." Familiar faces dot the tables around us. COPA, Matos, and Turnbull, who are married, and at COPA acted as chef and, for several years, beverage director respectively, opted against issuing a public announcement that the restaurant's last day would be August 3rd, instead privately notifying regulars, friends, collaborators, and former employees a few weeks in advance. The result, at least this evening, is a clientele who sit at low simmer, savoring the moment as they do the food. Doug Addington, our server for the night, is savoring time with the clientele too, lingering at nearby tables and chatting. At one point, patrons ask to take a photo with him. Not that we mind. When Addington finally makes it to our table, he offers a characteristic laugh and says, "Forgive me." Then he grins, folds his hands together, and adds, all in one breath, "Father, for I have sinned." It's a reverence we get, having worked with Addington. He spent a full career as a pastor before retiring and starting a new career in the restaurant industry at age 55. He met Turnbull and Kopamatos as a customer of the couple's previous venture, Old Havana Sandwich Shop, and has been with Copa since day one. His position at Copa is technically head server, and as of the past few years, after Turnbull took maternity leave, beverage manager, but his role more closely resembles that of a general manager, and he runs the entire front of house. He cares so much about the business and his people, you might assume he has a financial stake in it. He doesn't. He put together the list of contacts who received advance notice of the closure. He told me over the phone 2 days before Gabby and I came in, most of them I didn't know before I worked at Copa, and now I have friendships with them. After we put in our drink orders, Gabby and I examined the dinner menu. It's undergone some not insignificant changes since we left. The Ropa Vieja, national dish of Cuba that was once exalted by News and Observer food critic Greg Cox, has been cut from the list of mains. The duck leg confit, previously served whole on a bed of refried beans and mushrooms, is now being shredded into tacos. There's no paella. We decide we'll let Addington take the reins with the order. There are just two things we know we want, we tell him, the croquetas and the Cuban sandwich. Copa opened in March 2018, less than a month after Turnbull and Kopamatos, who is Cuban, shut down their sandwich shop. Old Havana stood for several years in a building just down the street from Copa's future location. It was lunch only and had a cult-like fan base. Turnbull and Kopamatos did notify the public ahead of shutting down Old Havana, disclosing in a release the restaurant's last day was imminent, but customers could rest assured that most of the menu would be available for lunch at their soon-to-be-open restaurant, Copa, billed as, quote, the nation's first truly farm-to-table Cuban restaurant. Copa would also serve a dinner menu inspired by Latin American recipes that have been lost to time and memory, said the release. Copa had a rosy first few years, but the pandemic was hard on upscale restaurants, particularly ones like Copa that care about their staff. Copa paid employees even when the restaurant shut down at the start of the pandemic, and at the risk of putting off customers, implemented a 20% auto-gratuity immediately upon reopening to make up for the loss of tips. Turnbull told The Indian 2021, people are notoriously low tippers on takeout. It kept not just a mask mandate, but a vaccine mandate in place for months. As stalwarts of the Durham restaurant scene, Turnbull and Kopamatos also spearheaded a number of efforts to drum up foot traffic on behalf of their business and others. They pressed the city council for a legitimate outdoor dining program and organized a Thursday night small plates crawl, but the traffic never came back. Copa couldn't afford to stay open during the day, and dinner traffic fell off as well. The opening time bumped up to 5:30. In April of this year, Turnbull and Kopamatos broke the news to customers they were nearing foreclosure and needed to file for bankruptcy. A friend launched a GoFundMe on the couple's behalf, citing the variable rate loan offered by the Small Business Administration in an era when interest rates have skyrocketed, and the sharp increase in the cost of doing business, doing rising prices and supply chain issues. As reasons, the two of them need urgent legal assistance to hold off foreclosure. The GoFundMe raised over $27,000, nearly double their stated goal, but Kopamatos told the NNO last week it wasn't enough, given the consistent lull in traffic, and that's why we're here. marking one of the restaurant's final nights. The plates start coming. Addington chose well. Braised beef in mole. Shrimp in frothy coconut curry sauce. A king-size empanada stuffed with potatoes and leeks. An off-menu bowl of succulent meat chunks and slaw that neither Gabby nor I have seen before. Addington calls it Catalan lamb. The Cuban sandwich and croquetas take the cake, but that lamb is a close third. As we're boxing up remnants of the meal, Copamatos moseys over and offers to make us each a cocktail. We nod, and he returns in a few minutes later with a glass of amber liquid. The drink is called La Diosa Negra, a blend of spiced rum, coffee liqueur, orange bitters, and Haitian vanilla. It's topped off, tableside, with a cloud of Cuban cigar smoke that's been trapped inside a mason jar. It's a nice way to end a meal, Copamatos says. As he pours the smoke, we ask him if there are certain occasions when he feels compelled to smoke a cigar. He thinks for a while. The occasion is emotion, he says. There are a few factors required for him to smoke one, he adds. He needs to either be pleased or concerned, and he needs to have the time. It feels like a natural close, and we thank him. Copamatos adds, I have something else to say. When I was in my 20s, I had a friend who would always say, good luck, bad luck, who knows? And he continues, sometimes something very good happens, but it turns into something very bad, and sometimes something very bad happens, but afterwards you say, I'm so glad. So he smiles and steps back from the table. So good luck, bad luck, who knows? He walks away. Then he comes back. Something else, he says. A cigar goes very well with straight Peruvian pisco. Now, folks, many times I've had to shelve articles, and sometimes they're kept beyond shelf life, but a theatrical review of a play that closed in June, I've kept. It's the Pure Life Theater Company, and it was a production of a play called Home. Tomasi McDonald wrote this, and I will go ahead and read it. It's not long, but we don't get to read enough drama reviews with all the other things that IndieWeek provides. This month, she writes, cast members of the Pure Life Theater's production have offered up a poignant and often laugh-out-loud performance at the Tony-nominated poem play, Home. Play closed out on June 20th as part of Burning Coals Theater's second stage series. The iridescent June 8th opening night performance at Raleigh's Burning Coal Theater by Ajani Kambone, Moriah Williams, and Tidium Coleman, under the direction of Jade Arnold, was especially meaningful, coming less than a month after Sam Art Williams, who wrote the play Home, died on May 13th in Burgaw, North Carolina. Williams, a playwright and executive producer for shows like Martin and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, was 78. Home was first performed in 1979 by the legendary New York-based Negro Ensemble Company. In addition to performances at Burning Coal on June 15, 16, 19, and 20, Home is currently in the midst of a Broadway revival produced by the Roundabout Theater Company with an opening night performance on June 5 at the Todd Hames Theater. Prior to his opening night production at Burning Coal, Triangle Theater titan Wendell Tabb introduced Linda Kerr Norflett, chair emerita of the North Carolina Central University Theater Department, who was a friend of Sam Art Williams and hired him as artist-in-residence during the 1980s in a stint that continued into the early 2000s. And Norflett told the audience he taught playwriting and how to take a play from the page to the stage. He thought it was important for the students to understand how to make a play live, and he created a booklet on how to make a theater budget. Norfolk described Williams as a man whose genial personality well fit into his imposing 6'6", 300-pound stature. Williams once served as a sparring partner for Muhammad Ali, lived in New York and California before returning home to Brigade to take care of his mother. Norfolk, who had visited his home, he was a neat man. Everything was polished and clean. He had a little desk where he worked, and where much of his work came from. He was such a humble guy, such a funny guy. He had all of these stories about the country farm, bringing the cows out first thing in the morning, milking the cows, curing tobacco, killing hogs. He was a jovial, crazy joker. Norfolk first met Williams in the late 1970s when she took a group of students to New York. Her mother, who is now 101, volunteered to chaperone and had wandered backstage before a performance by the Negro Ensemble Company. Norfolk's mother, who's from Mount Olive, emerged from backstage and announced she had met someone from her hometown. During Tab's introduction of Norfolk, he explained he had recently visited New York and saw The Wiz, that Tony Award-winning musical. Home was also up and running, but Tab said he elected to see the Burning Coal production instead. And in Raleigh, the Home players, no pun intended, did not disappoint. Home is a coming-of-age story about Cephas Miles, a farm boy who grew up in Crossroads, North Carolina. In his debut as a lead actor, Ajani Kambon embodies Cephas' hopes and loves, frustration and sadness, hilarious humor and poetry, heartbreak and triumph with the heart of a lion. Cambone capably transitions from an old man sitting on his porch in Crossroads to a teenager and loved with Patty May, luminously played by Mariah Williams, and then to an older working-class black man working in the city after serving time in prison for refusing to fight in Vietnam. Cambone, however, is at his best as a raconteur, sharing stories about growing up. He leaves the audience aching with laughter. Unquestionably, and even with the sparkling performances offered by Cambone and Williams, Tidium Coleman commanded the stage with a stunning mix of singing voice, movement phrases, narrative work, and smoking seduction that demanded the audience's attention. She was the most valuable player tonight, Arnold, the director, told me after the curtain fell. Kudos is due, too, for the minimalist set design that established country, city, and prison settings, along with the onstage props used to build character and place. Broadway's revival, notwithstanding Burning Coal's Home, is a beautifully rendered tribute to the legacy of Sam Art Williams. To paraphrase Langston Hughes, Home shows that even with life's hardships, it is not without laughter. Well, I'll close with another article written by Chase Pellegrini de Power about a rager party over in Chapel Hill recently. This article just printed, and the author's note said, "Our partners at the Assembly published a well-reported, nuanced, and intelligent story about the questions that remain in the aftermath of this $500,000 event. The following is not that story." She goes on, "If I learned only one thing in my recent college years, it's the recipe for a good frat party is deceptively simple. Take a group of sweaty 20-something-year-olds, pump them full of beer, drop them in a field with loud music. Rinse and repeat till they graduate and are forced to grapple with the gray monotony of everyday adult life as their youth slips away. The organizers of Flagstock, the 500,000 GoFundMe-powered Labor Day frat party in Chapel Hill, tried to improve that tried-and-true recipe by layering spectacle upon spectacle, including a star-studded performance lineup, a six-plane flyover, and a squad of Hooters girls so enthusiastic you'd think they were paid to be there. Sure, the party was entertaining. The music was great, and the message, love for red, white, and blue, with explicitly Republican shout-outs, came across loud and clear. But it wasn't that frat party fun as much as, quote, your uncle bought you and your friends some beer and also invited his friends, and don't worry, he got a permit from the county and hired security people, so you can't use your fake ID because alcohol law enforcement is here, and if you do anything dumb, there are a dozen journalists with cameras, and if you even go to the party, then people on campus will be mad, and you'll be hungover for class tomorrow, and most of the beer actually isn't free type of fun. A student stepped off at half-full coach buses at the American Legion Post number 6 on Monday evening. It became clear the party wouldn't draw, quote, between 25 and 3,000 participants, as the organizers, conservative operatives John Noonan and Susan Ralston, had promised on a press Zoom call earlier that week. No, official estimates are not yet available, but we in the press pavilion generously estimate between 300 and 500 attendees. Despite free wings and beer, hundreds of red solo cups and ping pong balls and a North Carolina-shaped ice luge, even the VIP tent, reserved for fraternities that actually had members at that flagpole in April, stood mostly empty. Matthew Broderick, a UNC student, when he stopped by the media pavilion before showtime, some people are going to be a little disappointed when they get here for sure. I think everybody was picturing an off-campus venue where maybe underage kids can have a drink, Broderick said, adding that he is of legal age and still expected to have a good time. When I asked Broderick if organizers could have done more to appeal to the college masses, he suggested maybe they could have gotten someone bigger to perform. Another student said that Post Malone would have been the ideal headliner. Though there were indeed a few diehard fans for the dad rock genre performer, the crowd seemed to have a good time, oohing and aahing as John Ondrasik, 5 for Fighting, opened with a beautiful rendition of 100 Years while 6 planes circled overhead. But they also stood around somewhat awkwardly while Ondrasik railed against, quote, the faculty that indoctrinates our kids with hatred and radicalism and the administrators and presidents of the universities across our nation that enable, encourage, and sometimes support the mobs running amok. Well, I'm forced to close that little reminiscence of Flagstock, and it's available, as all of these articles are, at IndieWeek.com online for those who are interested, and there always include more things as well, including their Best of the Triangle Awards in various categories. But for all of that, John Fetterson has to say so long until next week's issue of Indie Week. And so I will. Quote, so long.